listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. After years of working in organized labor, Andy Levin spent 4 years as a member of Congress in the U.S. House of Representatives. His defeat in the primary last August snapped a four-decade run by the Levin family in Congress. Levin's father, Sander, served in the House for 36 years, and his uncle Carl was a six-term U.S. senator. Recently, Andy sat down with WDET's Russ McNamara at a Southfield coffee shop to talk about Levin's electoral loss, what he's working on now, and how he thinks we should be navigating our toughest political challenges.
Last August, primary between yourself and Haley Stevens. You ran in the same redistricted district and you lost. There was a ton of dark money that was pumped into your race, specifically against you, and the money going towards Haley Stevens. A lot of that came from an AIPAC offshoot. AIPAC, of course, being a very powerful lobby within Washington, D.C. and countrywide. As a Jewish man, did that hurt?
Well, I think it hurt our democracy. It hurt me personally to have that much money spent against me. But I think there's a couple of big points about it, Russ. Number one, I think that we have to have in America an open debate about our policy towards our friend Israel. I'm a big backer of Israel, but we cannot let dark money or any other money shut down. Look at what's happening in Israel today with the threats to democracy itself there, with the horrible violence that's happening. If we're Israel's best friend, we better be able to have an honest conversation here. And that dark money is aimed at shutting that down. They felt I was the most dangerous member of Congress because I'm Jewish and I come from a prominent Jewish family, and I was the most strong voice for saying we can be pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian. We need peace. We need to find a way to realize Palestinian political and human rights in order to have a Jewish state that's democratic and secure. That's just true. That's what I believe. And it's a shame that so much dark money came in to try to shut that down. There's a second piece about it, though, right?
Yeah.
That was a Democratic primary, right? A great deal of the AIPAC money that came in was from Republicans, from Republican billionaires. And whether you're the Democratic Party, Republican Party, or some other party, you can't really let money come in from other parties to pick your candidates in your primaries, or you've pretty much lost control of your political party. So that's something I think the Democratic Party needs to look at. And look, this time it was AIPAC. ExxonMobil isn't dumb. Big Pharma isn't dumb. Some of these other big interests that are hostile to the Democratic Party are going to look and say, hey, why don't we pick the nominee from the Republican side and the Democratic side? So it's something, that's another element that I think this dark money is so destructive to American politics in general. Mm-hmm. And I fought against it. You know, I was the author of the bill, part of our overall HR1 package. My bill was about sunshine on corporate giving, since we have this bad Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court, at least make corporations tell their shareholders and thus the public what political spending they're doing. So there's a lot of work to be done in that area in general, and I'm afraid this AIPAC chapter was, you know, a difficult exposure of one sordid aspect of it.
Does that make you more or less likely to run for office again?
I don't think it has any impact. I mean, I'm 62. I've served 4 years in Congress. It was fantastic. I loved it. I hope I made some little contribution. The rest of my adult life, I've worked in the labor movement, the environmental movement, the human rights movement. I worked in the Clinton administration a little bit in the Labor Department. I served with Governor Granholm in the state here, helping on job training and clean energy stuff. And so whether I serve in the government again, I'm not sure, but I will I'll be doing public service no matter what to help the working people of this country and to try to save this planet as we know it from the disastrous overheating that we're inflicting on it.
Because you obviously like voices like yours in Congress, is there any regret whatsoever about not sliding over to the 10th Congressional District, the one that John James narrowly won that mostly consisted of Macomb County?
Right. I don't regret it. I mean, my daughter, Molly's still in high school here. She's going to graduate. It's just so important for me to be a present parent. That really comes first. You know, Carl Marlinga is from Macomb County. He so represents everything about Macomb County. He came close to winning that race. So, you know, that's something that we have to obviously all look at in the future as Democrats. We want to win that seat back. But I'm right now, what I'm thinking about is, and here we are just in the first quarter of 2023, how can I make the best contribution towards justice in America and all around the world? And so that's really what I'm focused on.
Yeah, what is the best way to do that? you're now working for the Center for American Progress, and you've got other couple other gigs that you were already working yourself into. So is that the best use of your time as you see fit right now?
Yeah, no, I'm really happy. We did just announce that I'm a distinguished senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. I'm going to be working there on a national basis and certainly focusing on Michigan on how to have a just economy, how to protect democracy at home and all around the world. There's an amazing team there headed by my friend Patrick Gaspard, who has his own rich history. He was ambassador to South Africa. He was political director in the Obama White House.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he's a Haitian American guy because I still am very involved in our policy towards Haiti. So we even talk about that. But they have a wonderful team there. I'm also working in other ways. And here's what I'm focused on, Ross. Number one, we can't rebuild the middle class in this country unless we reduce the drastic income and wealth inequality. We need to do that, several things about that, have a more just tax structure, not have child labor like we're seeing in the news right now.
Right.
But probably the most fundamental thing we can do is to allow workers to form unions and bargain collectively in this country again to scale. We're down to 6% of private sector workers having a union at a moment when the public is wildly favorable towards unions and almost half of non-union workers say they'd like to have one. What's the problem? Our labor laws are so skewed. So we've got to help all these workers at Starbucks and Amazon and Trader Joe's and REI and all these other companies who are organized. We got to help them organize, and then we have to help them try to get first contracts. 2023 is a crucial year. In 2022, almost 300 Starbucks organized.
Right.
Does one of those stores have a first contract? No. Does Howard Schultz intend on ever letting them? No. Would that happen in any other advanced industrialized country? No way. So we have to, and I'm involved in this and it's so fun, how can we strategize to help them actually get a first contract, but along the way, help the American people see almost with something on the level of, say, Cesar Chavez's great boycott.
Mm-hmm.
Not that it's a boycott, but what's the strategy for 2023 to help the American people realize, whoa, people at Starbucks, these young baristas who are organizing, if they can't even get a contract with their employer, what kind of economy do we have? We have to change that. People have to be able to have a little modicum of democracy in the workplace and get their little slice of the American dream. So I'm working on that. Big time.
How is that enforced, though? I mean, is it the fault of the National Labor Relations Board, or are we working off an old framework that doesn't
totally
necessarily work?
Totally outdated framework. Yeah, totally outdated framework. And it's the National Labor Relations Board swings back and forth with the political winds way too much. That started with Reagan, and it's supposed to be the agency that enforces workers' rights, not enforces workers' rights when there's a Democratic president and helps employers violate workers' rights when there's a Republican president.
Right.
But still in all, as you point out, the framework itself is outdated and the playing field is so tilted against workers. Here's the actual labor law for the private sector. When workers form a union, what does the boss actually have to do? They have to show up several times at the bargaining table. They have to make proposals. Do the proposals have to be in the realm of reasonable? Not at all. So Starbucks can literally come to the table and say, oh, we propose that you all make 20% less than you did before and nobody has health care. That's perfectly legal. Then they show up for a certain number of sessions and they say, oh, I guess we don't agree. We're declaring an impasse. They have legally, under the current law, under the National Labor Relations Act, they've discharged their duty to bargain. And now, if you dare to go on strike, they can permanently replace you. And that's the state of U.S. Right. labor. So effectively, workers don't really have rights. And that should highlight to everybody how brave these workers are across so many employers who are organizing anyway. And we're going to have to come to some kind of a crisis in our society where beyond just little talk in Washington, people realize, whoa, we really can't have a fair economy, a just economy, fairness for workers. And by the way, this disproportionately hurts women and workers of color, for sure. We can't tackle those issues unless we update this labor law so that workers can just organize if they darn well please, so that when they do organize, they can get a first contract, and so that they can support each other in their struggles, which they also aren't allowed to do now under federal law. So to just give you one example of what the PRO Act that we proposed and I helped lead on in Congress would do, it has first contract, mediation, and binding arbitration so that within about 7 months, workers would have a first contract every time. That works. That works for the American people, and we've got to get to that point.
We're coming to a time where, and you alluded to the Gallup poll, where support for unions is at the highest level in 50 years. We're also switching up the economy and moving to greener pastures, greener jobs, as it were. How much does that coincide with what you want to do in the future?
It's all about what I'm doing post-Congress. I mean, you may remember that before I ran for Congress, I created and ran a statewide market called Lean and Green Michigan, but it's based on PACE, or Property Assessed Clean Energy, a statute we passed right at the end of the Granholm administration. It allows businesses and nonprofits to have a way to effectively finance clean energy makeovers of their buildings. 42% of all the energy we use in the United States is to cool or heat and light our buildings, homes, businesses, factories, everything. And generally, most buildings, you can eliminate 35% of that of that energy use. And, of course, then there's producing renewable energy. Lean and Green Michigan helps finance all that stuff in a way that is a perfect example of a really good kind of public-private partnership. The county, typically, or the city or township gets involved. They put a property tax assessment on that building for the cost of the upgrade. And then it cash flows for the owner of the building to do that.
Right.
We've done $200 million of that kind of financing in Michigan so far. Now, when I went to Congress, the ethics people said, give that to leave that business. I sold it to my wife for a dollar, whatever they told me was the appropriate way to do it. Mm-hmm. Now she's saying, hey, get back in here and help out. So she still owns it, but I'm definitely going to be working to expand that. And there are going to be a lot of fantastic projects this year. And then I'm especially, though, working at what you were getting at, the intersection of workers' rights, education, job training, all the things workers need, with what needs to be a very rapid transition to a renewable energy economy. We've got to make electric vehicles. We want to make them here in Michigan. We want them American-made. We want the darn batteries American-made. We want all those to be good union jobs. We need to put up way more renewable energy in the form of solar panels, onshore wind, offshore wind. We need more storage or battery storage and other forms of storage. All this could be built with union labor, good jobs across many different unions. This could be a renaissance of rebuilding the middle class in America, but also getting at our original sins of racism and realizing we can open up these opportunities to people who've too long been excluded. And, that's something I worked on way back when I was at the Department of Energy, Labor, and Economic Growth, and I ran the workforce system of this country. we had a senator from Illinois. You may have heard of him. His name was Barack Obama. When he was a U.S. senator, he got a little thing passed through Congress that allowed the states to use 0.5% of our safety lieu money. I don't know why they call it that, but it's the money to construct highways.
Okay.
To train the workforce of the future for highway construction, which was defined as women, people of color, and poor people. Boom. We used that money in Michigan to create training programs. We called one Road Construction Apprenticeship Readiness. We made a pre-apprenticeship programs to help those groups of people be able to test into apprenticeships to get those great jobs. We did it in other kinds of jobs. We should do that with this whole transition to a renewable energy economy.
You can't teach an old dog new tricks, and you can teach an old Teamster new tricks, but it's going to cost you. How do you reprogram the current workforce into embracing a more green strategy? Inclusive workforce.
I'll tell you what you make me think of, Russ. So when Jennifer Granholm won her second term and I came home to Michigan, she said, "You have to help me figure out how to help all these unemployed people." You remember it was the Great Recession. We had the highest unemployment. Michigan had the highest unemployment rate of any state for 49 consecutive months. And those were the months that I was in charge of figuring out what to do with it. And what we did was we created No Worker Left Behind. That's what the program was called. And we put 162,000 unemployed and underemployed Michiganders back to school. Why do I mention that? Because here's what people said to me. "Andy, these people are in their late 20s, 30s, 40s, even 50s. They don't want to go back to community college. They'll feel alienated from those young people who are so culturally different." People said all those kind of things. Russ, we had a waiting list for No Worker Left Behind in every one of Michigan's 83 counties. People had a great time. If you give them the support they need, they had a great time going back. It's not about necessarily getting a whole 4-year degree or even a 2-year degree. So a lot of people did that, but people got the certificates. There might be an IT certificate they needed. Mm-hmm. There might be an advanced manufacturing program they could do. Tons of people went in health. The biggest of all was healthcare. 38%. I still remember the number of people in No Worker Left Behind were studying either in a certified nurse aide, nursing track, an LPN, RN, other allied health professionals, all the techs. We had x-ray techs and nuclear medicine techs and all those kind of people. And people went back and got the skills they needed to get a great middle-class job in this state. And whether it's advanced manufacturing, IT, healthcare, we need all that even more right now. And to make this transition to renewable energy, a lot of people are going to need to get new skills, but we shouldn't be afraid of it. We should embrace it. And I think it's a little bit of a stereotype to think the workers themselves won't embrace it. They will, and they'll have a great life if we can help them, give them the resources they need to get there.
We've heard a lot over the last 7-8 years about making America great again. What I've heard from you so far is a lot of optimism. Do you still have that optimism? Even though you've transitioned into a different role, I guess.
Oh, I'm incredibly optimistic. The thing is this. We have to take very seriously how difficult the situation we are in is. It's difficult, Russ. Our democracy. We came close to losing our democracy, and we better not fall asleep and think it can't happen, because it almost did and it still could. We have to shore up our democracy in many ways. We have to shore up voting rights. We have to shore up access to the polls. We have to make sure that people aren't taken off voting lists. We have to try to deal with all the dark money in politics. We have to make sure that people can't overturn the results of elections where the voters make their choices. So that is very important. We have to do that. And also, I'm not Pollyannish about what a disaster we've gotten ourselves into by continuously putting immense amount of carbon into the atmosphere and other warming gases like methane and others. We've known about this since the 80s pretty fully. Every week almost there seems like a new scientific discovery about the granular details. But we've known the basics about this for 40 years, and shame on us that we've allowed it to get to this point. Here's the optimism, though. Number one, it's smacking us in the face, so people are pretty much realizing it. And number two, there's no sense that this has to be some dour, horrible medicine, you know, take your castor oil, you know, kind of a situation. This is economic opportunity. This is an area, if we can, you know, where we can
actually... That sounds very capitalistic, by the way.
Well, that's the system we live in. But look, let's get beyond capitalism, socialism, and other things. We are in a very difficult relationship with China right now, right? We've let them trade in unfair ways. They're rattling sabers. They've gone back on the agreement about Hong Kong. People are worried that they're going to try to forcibly, you know, take Taiwan back, all this stuff. But if you look big picture on climate change, we need so many solar panels, so many electric vehicles. They don't need to sell their stuff here. We can both produce way, way more than we produce now. We must produce way more than we do now and distribute them throughout the globe. Sell them. Yes, it's capitalism. But, you know, we need, the U.S. can give a lot of aid. And like when I was in Congress, oh, my goodness, the anxiety about China, the Belt and Road Initiative, the way they go out and go around, you know, Asia, Africa, Latin America, and they get these countries in hock, but they help build a lot of infrastructure for them. Well, instead of being anxious about that, what about a big-hearted, broad-shouldered American strategy that isn't just responsive to China, but actually says, well, what needs to happen?
Right.
These poor countries need to switch really fast. A lot of them never had 24, they don't have 24/7 electricity. A lot of villages around the world hardly have it. Just like a lot of places leapfrogged never really having landlines to being able to put cell towers here and there and having phone service, we could help poor countries around the world get reliable 24/7 electricity, advance their economies, and we would have to produce a lot of wind towers, nacelles, everything, the blades, everything about the wind turbines, all about the solar stuff. So, you know, I think this country is waking up, thanks to the pandemic, that and that we, for our national security, for our health security, we have to make a lot more here, and we should do it in collaboration with poorer countries so that they get more jobs, we get more jobs. You know, let's talk about the building trades. A country that's so close to my heart, Haiti, in such dire straits. Haiti is on an island of Hispaniola. It's got tons of coastline. Let's say there's a significant offshore wind capacity in Haiti. Nobody's even, people are just thinking, oh, what about the last earthquake or what about the political situation? But if you think about what needs to happen, think about all the Haitian American members of the operating engineers, the laborers, the carpenters, especially in Florida, New York, and Massachusetts. But, you know, they're over a million Haitian Americans. Imagine if they had the opportunity to go lead construction of renewable energy resources in a country like Haiti and train Haitians to be apprentices so they could build the union there, build middle-class jobs there, and do that. But, yeah, I think we should be really optimistic about what we could do with this moment. Moments of crisis call for real leadership. And if you don't have vision about how to go forward, step aside because we don't have time to mess around here.
That was former Congressman Andy Levin. He spoke with WDET's Russ McNamara. That's going to do it for us on Detroit Today. Come back tomorrow when we're going to talk about all the state legislation coming out of Lansing these days. This is 101.9 WDET-FM, Detroit's NPR station, your connection to news, music, and conversation. We'll talk again tomorrow.